So hello, this is Co-Chair Rena Moran. Pursuit of House Rule 10.01, I call this remote meeting of the Select Committee on Racial Justice to order. For verification, Alyssa, do we have a quorum present?
Madam Chair, a quorum is present.
All right, thank you. So we're going to move on to the minutes and try to get some approvals of the minutes from our last meeting on October the 13th, 2020. Vice Chair Dama, have you read the minutes?
Thank you, Co-Chair Moran. Yes, I have read the minutes, and I would move those of the October 20th meeting.
So Representative Dama has moved the minutes for October the 20th. All in favor, say aye.
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 Any opposed? Great. So the minutes for October the 20th, 2020 has been approved. So, you know, this has been a long time coming. So we're going to move on to the walkthrough of the reports and the recommendations. This has been a really time-consuming effort. It has been an inspiring effort. And I would say in so many ways, it has been a much needed effort and process. And so I just want to share with folks that, you know, as chair of the Health and Human Service Policy Committee, which is one of the biggest committees in the legislature next to the Education Committee, that being a chair of that committee has been an awesome experience. But it has been a much easier experience than being a co-chair of the Select Committee on Racial Justice. And it has been, in my mind, an easier process because, you know, as a committee chair, you have members who brings bill to the committee and on issues that they care about that folks from across the state are asking and requesting, or we see a need for it, and we have hearings on it. But for this Select Committee on Racial Justice, the process was different. Yes, we had hearings. We had several hearings. We had public testimony. But within that, we found that my co-chair, Representative Richardson, and I found that, there have been so many other conversations besides the conversation that took place in the hearing. There have been so much data that is out there that we did not get a complete scope of all the data and the research that has been done around the issues of racism, around the issues of racial justice, around racial inequities. And so that meant that was some work that we still had to complete, you know, conversation with folks. There was still work that had to be done. And I know as Representative Richardson and I and others were having this conversation, my thought was, you know, we have great data out there, but the question is, why do the data present itself the way that it does? Why do the data consistently talk about the disparities that the Black, Indigenous, and communities of color are less off than our white population, right? So it was always this question of why. And so it was clear to us that in order to really do this report justice, that we had to dig deeper. We had to have a comprehensive report that not only was informative, but was educational. And often what we know is some of this information that we know as African-Americans, as Blacks, and as Indigenous and people of color, this is information that we know because it's been handed down from generation to generation. Well, we understand that the dominant population may have never, or maybe don't even know this history, and may not even know or understand the language that we're using around racial justice. So it was really important that we started off by giving definitions to the words that has been used by different entities, right? This has been that, you know, that has so many different meanings for so many different people, that yet in our minds, we have not really grasped what the real definitions of something as simple as racial justice or social justice or equity. And so within this document, you will find us opening up to begin this process with some definitions. So I just want to remind people real quickly about the enabling legislation that we have, that we started off with. But before I go into the document itself, I would like to create an opportunity for my co-chair, Representative Richardson, to also share some thoughts.
Thank you, Co-Chair Moran. I wanted to just echo some of the sentiments that you had shared around how heavy of a document that this is. There is a lot of history in this document. There's a lot of data that is within this document. And it was also, it wasn't lost on me that there's also a lot of historical trauma and pain within this document as well. And so the work that has been done as part of this committee and the work that has been done to put together this report has definitely been a very difficult endeavor. And so I don't want that, I don't want that to be lost. You know, when we started the meeting as a House Select Committee on Racial Justice, we talked about the fact that, you know, talking about race, talking about racism within the state and within this country is a very, they're very difficult conversations to be had. And the reason that the conversations are so difficult is because there are things that are deeply wrong. These would not be hard conversations if there were not issues, if there were not concerns that are deeply difficult. And so I really just want to take this moment to thank everyone who has been a part of the committee and volunteering and agreeing to engage in these uncomfortable conversations. And I also want to thank the folks who voted in support of the House Resolution 1, which declared racism as a public health crisis and which ultimately was the vehicle for beginning this House Select Committee on racial justice. And I also want to take a moment to thank both Vice Chair Damuth and Representative Erdahl for rising to speak on the House floor in support of House Resolution 1 when it was presented as well. The work that we have done as a committee would not have been possible without our strong and dedicated staff. So I do also want to take a moment to recognize all of the staff that have been assigned to the committee, Lindy and Alyssa, Laura, Pat McCormick and his team, Mary Mullen, and Callie Lehman and Joe Durham as well. They make us look good, and they support us in many ways in order to be able to be focused on the work that that we are sent here to do. So with that, again, just thank you to everyone for giving your time to participate within the committee. And I'm looking forward to walking through the document and having a rich discussion today.
Yes. And so with that, you know, our original plan was to have this last hearing last week, but here we are in the week of Christmas. So I do want to thank also every member that is here today to participate in this hearing. It means a lot. And so as you just heard, Representative Ruth gave us some information about the enabling resolution and how this select committee came to be. And so Alyssa, if you can maybe pull up the document for us, that would be helpful. Okay, there we go. Beautiful.
Okay, are you able to, Madam Chair, is the screen sharing?
Yes, I can see it. Can members, are, is everyone able to see the screen?
Yes.
Yes. Okay, yes. Beautiful. Perfect. Can we slide down and go to the select committee meetings? And so I just want to start off here by just reminding us that the select committee held a series of informational hearings focused on providing definitions, a historical framework, and the current data related to the impact of systemic racism and race-related disparities in the field of health, education, housing, public safety, and economics. We invited some experts and researchers from Minnesota and from across the United States to testify and conduct public hearings to gather testimony from interest community members from around the state. And, you know, we always want to hear from community members. The voices of our community is what drive us as legislators to come up here and to show up for our constituency. So we always want to make sure we can at least provide that type of opportunity. But we also know that people are busy with their lives. They're dealing with crisis. They're dealing with COVID. They're dealing with their own families. And not everyone gets an opportunity to speak on one day. And so, you know, we ask for a written testimony, you know, for emails, leave a phone call. And we also had space to just make time for people when people are available to talk to us, to have those conversations with other people that is outside of the committee time. That's the work of being a co-chair. You know, our work seemed to have never ended. It was just a consistent process of engaging and listening and learning and gathering information. And so why don't we go down, Alyssa, to it's a little bit there. So the meeting one was on September 22nd that focused on what is racism, the maternal child health mortality and morbidity, reproductive health, with meeting two on September 29th around ACEs, which is adverse childhood experiences and racism. We went on to the meeting three, where we looked at historical trauma of Indigenous people in Minnesota and historical trauma of African Americans in Minnesota. Meeting fourth was our opportunity to create a space for public testimony to testify on the impact of racism on communities in Minnesota. And meeting five on October 20, where the select committee watched an excerpt from the Twin City Public Television documentary on Jim Crow of the North, and also her testimony from Dr. Bruce Corey on the economic cost of racism. Very, very informative information. And so here we are today on December 22nd as we walk through this document and have a discussion around what we have before us. So I'm gonna just go through some of these definitions, but some of them I will highlight more than others, because I think it's really, this kind of like sets the foundation and the tone of this document that we're going, that we have before us. And so I want to just start with racism. And I read a little bit about racism, because I think this is like really important. It is not uncommon for conversation on racism to derail when people are using terminology in different ways. A key challenge to effective communication about race is to move people from the individualized definition of racism to a focus on a systemic interpretation of racism. According to Annie E. Casey Foundation, to illuminate racism, we need to and we must name it, frame it, and then explain it. The foundation speaks to the importance of establishing a shared language to present data, describe conditions and outcomes, and identify the root causes of inequities to create a platform for coordinated work towards equitable outcomes. So according to the Public Health Association, racism is defined as a system of structuring opportunities and assigning value based on the social interpretation of how one looks, which is what we call race, that unfairly disadvantages some individuals and communities. It unfairly advantages other individuals and communities, And at the base of all of this, it is sapping the strength of the whole society through the waste of human resources. Racism is a system, not an individual character flaw or a personal moral failing. I want us to just hear that again, that racism is a system, not an individual character flaw or a personal moral failing. And I say that recognizing that people can be racist, but as legislators, we're going to look at the structural piece of racism, the system. It is a system of power that structures opportunities such as education, housing, job, justice, and assigns value or worthy or unworthiness, full of potential or full of menace, based on the so-called race, the social interpretation of how we look. We brought in Dr. Kamara Jones, who said the system of racism has three critical impacts. First, racism unfairly disadvantages some individuals and community. Her words, when we think or talk about racism at all in this country, this is what we see. But it is important to understand that with every unfair advantage, it has a reciprocal unfair advantage. And the second impact of racism is that it unfairly advantages other individuals and community. This is the whole notion of unearned white privilege, that sometimes we hear this word about white privilege. Nothing that you have to do, it's just unearned, you get it just because of the color of your skin, that we hardly ever talk about in this nation. And the third and perhaps the most profound impact is that racism is zapping the strength of the whole society by wasting human resources, right? When the brilliance in some of our communities is ignored and we're not invested in the full education of our kids because we don't think there's genius in the barrels or in the ghettos or on the reservation, that is sapping the strength of our whole society. In short, the definition of racism is not centered on a narrow interpretation of who's racist and who's not. Rather, the definition is more comprehensively focused on the systemic impact of racism, which has a harmful impact on our entire state and nation. We are all adversely impacted by the system of racism, and we all play a role in addressing the adverse impacts. So bear with me on these definitions. So we have internalized racism, which describes the private racial beliefs held by and within individuals. The way we absorb social messaging about race and adopt them as a personal belief, biases and prejudices are all within the realm of internalized racism. For people of color, like myself, internalized oppression can involve believing in negative messages about oneself or one racial group. For white people, internalized privilege can involve feeling a sense of superiority and entitlement, or even holding negative beliefs about people of color. Institutional racism is a racial inequity within institutions and systems of power, such as places of employment, government agencies, and social services. It can take the form of unfair policies and practices, discriminatory treatment, inequitable opportunities and outcome. For example, here's an example. A school system that concentrates people of color in the most overcrowded and under-resourced schools with the least qualified teachers compared to the educational opportunities of white students is an example of institutional racism. Equity. We use the words equity all the time. We're like all over the place about equity versus equality. Because I hear this all the time. We're just going to get everybody the same thing. So let me give you a definition of what that means. Equity involves trying to understand and give people what they need to enjoy full, healthy lives. That's all it is, right? Just trying to understand and give people what they need to enjoy a full, healthy lives. Equality, in contrast, aims to ensure that everyone gets the same thing in order to enjoy a full, healthy life. Like equity, equality aims to promote fairness and justice, but it can only work if everyone starts from the same place and needs the same things. And we are not starting from the same place. Inclusion is the act or state of including and or being included within a group or structure. More than simply diversity and numerical representation, right? We want to say, oh, we got diversity here. We have like 5 people of color in this business, right? But inclusion involves authentic and empowered participation and a true sense of belonging. That's why often we, in our state, we have this issue with hiring diverse groups of people, but we cannot sustain them in those positions. Inclusion. Social justice. Justice is the concept of fairness. Social justice is fairness as it manifests in society. That includes fairness in healthcare, employment, housing, and more. Discrimination and social justice are not compatible. Racial privilege, like two sides of the same coin. Racial privilege describes race-based advantages, preferential treatment based on skin color, while racial oppressions refer to race-based disadvantages, discrimination, and exploitation based on skin color. In the social determinants of health, I'm not going to read all of that, but I want to highlight this part of the social determinant of health. Let's see where it starts here. Resources that enhance the quality of life can have a significant influence on population health outcomes. Examples of these resources include safe and affordable housing, access to education, public safety, availability of healthy food, local emergency health services, and in an environment that is free of life-threatening toxin. That's a short version of the social determinants of health. I know Ruth might be like, you need to read more. Representative Richardson needs to read more. But there we go with that. Okay, and environmental justice. And so I just want to just say this out loud, because I do recognize that we did not get the opportunity to hear testimony around environmental justice. We had a gentleman by the name of Mr. James Trice, who were on to testify around environmental justice and what that looks like through the lens of racial equity, racial justice. But was, for whatever reason, there was some confusion with the Zoom information, so he was not available. But we were able to create an opportunity where the working group came together to hear from James, from Mr. Trice. And he is also on here to be made available for any questions that we may have around environmental justice. But the principle of environmental justice asserts that no people, based on their race or economic status, should be forced to bear a disproportionate burden of environmental risk. Environmental justice deals explicitly with the distribution of environmental benefits and the burden people experience at home, at work, or where they learn, play, worship, and spend their leisure time. In short, environmental justice is an important part of the struggle to improve and maintain a clean and healthful environment, especially for those who have traditionally lived, worked, and played closest to the sources of pollution. And so with that, those are some definitions. Sure, there are probably more and other definitions that we still have questions around and may need to hear about. But we think those are, that sets a really good tone for the conversations that you hear others here having around racial inequities, about racism, racial disparities. And I'm hoping that there was a starting point as you began to continue to educate yourself on other words that you may hear, that you take time to dig deep and find out what are they talking about. So with that, I'm going to stop there for me, and I'm going to pass this on to Representative Richardson.
Thank you, Co-Chair Moran. So getting into sort of the meat of the report, we are at section four, looking at the Minnesota paradox, which really relates to the ideals that Dr. Samuel Myers has done in his work at the University of Minnesota. And it's really a reflection of the fact that Minnesota, while having some of the best outcomes in many areas of life and the quality of life, there's also this sort of tale of two states, that we also have some of the worst disparities as well when it comes to looking across many of our systems. So not only within our economic development system, but within education, housing, child welfare, public safety, and so on. And so one of the things that we really tried to ensure that this report was able to capture is the reality that the disparities that we see today, many are tied to very specific policy decisions and legislation that was government sanctioned. And so really understanding how specific government sanctioned policies have sort of, they've set up a trajectory to, as Rep. Moran talked about, the fact that when we talk about people not all starting from the same place, we have to really understand that historical legacy of government sanctioned policies that were not colorblind or color neutral, that were specifically written in ways that created an unequal playing field and barriers for Black and Indigenous and people of color. So within the context of this section, we also reiterated the findings of the committee, and those were findings that really were set the basis for House Resolution 1, recognizing that systemic racism in fact does exist, that it is harmful, and that systemic racism must be addressed, and that was really the crux of what we were undertaking with this House Select Committee on Racial Justice. Can you continue to scroll, Alyssa, please? So just, there you go. So then just looking at the most recent census data in terms of the race breakdown of the state, as you can see, Black, Indigenous, Latinx, and other communities of color make up about 20% of the state's demographic. We know that 2020, we're in a new year, and that there's new census data that is going to be released soon. But this information from the American Community Survey data is the most recent data that we have from 2019. So the economic costs of racism, that is something that we spent quite a bit of time on committee discussing, and I think everyone had the opportunity to look at the report from Citi. And, you know, just as a reminder, in terms of the way that report was drafted, it was looking specifically at discrimination within the Black community, and estimated that over the last 20 years that there was an estimated $16 trillion that was lost to the U.S. economy just on the basis of discrimination within the Black community. So it wasn't looking broader along BIPOC communities, Black, Indigenous, Latinx, people of color, Asian Americans, but just looking within that that narrow subset. And in terms of the impact on job creation, there was an estimated 6.1 million jobs that were not generated over the past 20 years as a result of that discrimination as well. Committee members will recall that Dr. Corey came in and provided the research on Minnesota specifically in terms of the not only money lost, he did a breakdown in terms of looking at the $22 billion lost in Minnesota because of the wage gap, $174 billion lost in lifetime opportunities because of the educational opportunity gap, and then the $24 billion loss that's estimated as a result of barriers in home ownership and higher rent burdens, and spent a little bit of time talking about the barriers that minority-owned businesses are facing in terms of getting access to capital, and that is an estimated $67 billion loss in business revenue because of the capital gap. For those who haven't had the opportunity to do more in-depth looks at the Dr. Corey's webpage and his research, I highly encourage all members to look at the data, because he has data broken down by house districts as well. So you can go online and look at your specific house district and see where there are potential opportunities that would really make a difference in terms of addressing systemic racism. And so just that real understanding that our state and our nation will continue to be less prosperous as long as we continue to uphold a system that is, as Rena pointed out, sapping the strength of human resources. Those losses are things that impact all of us across the state. So there is definitely an economic imperative to addressing systemic racism as well. Moving on, looking at the racial gap, and if you could continue to scroll up, Alyssa. So looking at the median income information is listed here, and you can see the stark differences in earning. The state of Minnesota has the second largest income inequality gap between Black and whites in the United States. Only the District of Columbia is worse. And so when we're talking about these deep disparities, this is one example. And, you know, sort of getting to the why, we'll talk a little bit about Minnesota's wage gap, which the data is there in terms of looking at the amount earned on the dollar. And there's a wage gap between white Minnesotans and other communities as well. And as you can see, with for every dollar that white Minnesotans earn, for Indigenous populations, they earn about 68 cents on that dollar. The COVID pandemic has, I think, really shined a light on the deep disparities that we have within our state and within our nation as well. And it has really served to only further exacerbate current disparities. So prior to the COVID-19 pandemic, the unemployment rate in Minnesota was at a historic low. But even with that historic low, it was still double the rate of white unemployment. And since the COVID pandemic, what the data has really shown is that about half of Black Minnesotans have lost their jobs and have to apply for unemployment. So one out of two Black Minnesotans, compared with one in four white Minnesotans as well. And so understanding that some of the nuances around the COVID pandemic in terms of who were affected, you know, thinking through like frontline workers and some industries that have been hit very hard, like hospitality industries. Those were oftentimes industries that had high percentages of BIPOC workers. And so we're continuing to see that divide even within COVID. The housing disparities, and I'll maybe pause there to see if there's any questions on what has been or comments. Co-Chair Moran, if that's okay, or do you want to finish up the housing disparities?
No, let's just do a pause and see if we have any questions from any members. Comments? Okay. Okay, well, we'll move forward. And so here before us, we have the housing disparities. You know, so access to safe and affordable housing, as we all know, is the foundation of a healthy life. In the United States and in Minnesota, housing has been a foundation for racism, discrimination, and exclusion. There is a historical record of discriminatory displacement in Minnesota, and the legacy that those forced removals are felt even in the present day. The forced removal of the Dakota people in 1851, the destruction of the immigrants' community on the Riverside Flats in the 1960s, the displacement of upper middle class, and working class Black Minnesotans in the Rondo community with the construction of I-94, are just a few examples of the discriminatory practices that we've seen around housing. At one point in Minnesota history, Black residents had high home ownership rates, right? And when we look to the Rondo community here in St. Paul, you know, there was high numbers of home ownership, and with the construction of I-94, coming through and just really dismantling the foundation of that Black community, the loss of jobs, the loss of businesses, the loss of home ownership, all happened within the Rondo community. Unfortunately, these households faced government-sanctioned displacements in their neighborhoods, encountering redlining policies, and had to contend to discriminatory policies that limit their employment opportunity. The State of the State Housing of 2019 reports demonstrate that the failure to address significant increased gaps between housing costs and the income has created severe and damaging impact that disproportionately impact Black, Indigenous, and communities of color, people of color in Minnesota. As you know, as many of the first from Minnesota, we have one of the largest renters population in the upper Midwest, with over 611,000 renter households. In addition, Minnesota consistently has one of the highest homeowner rates in the country. However, for BIPOC households, who are much likely to own homes than white households, while 77% of white household own their homes, 57% of Asians, 46% of Native American, 45% of Latex, and just 24% of Black households own their homes. We're going to scroll down a little bit more, Alyssa. So we know there is a home ownership. There's a home ownership gap, but there's also a cost burden gap. And so a cost burden is when a household spends more than 30% of its income on housing. When housing costs exceed 30% of the household income each month, families are less likely to have sufficient resources to pay for basic things like food, medicine, healthcare, and transportation. And what we also seem to find under this data that is not there, but when the house burden becomes so extreme, also what happens is homelessness, not just of individuals, for whole families. Home ownership is critical to the accumulation of wealth, and it is a significant factor in the stark difference between the net worth of white families and Black families. In the United States, people have primarily built their wealth and transferred it to their descendants through home ownership. All of that was lost, much of that was lost, a lot of that was lost within the Rondo community. when those homes was taken from individuals. Many obstacles, including government sanctioned policies and programs, has hindered the ability of Black Minnesotans to buy property. The Federal Housing Administration played a significant role in denying home ownership to Black Minnesotans by refusing to insure mortgage in predominantly Black neighborhoods in a practice known as redlining. Redlining, right? A system of redlining built by design as a cycle of segregation. That segregation has persisted for decades, even after redlining was suspended. The result is a significant gap between white and Black home ownership today, the largest since 1890. The racial housing gap is a driving factor in the racial wealth gap. And another critical driving factor is the fact that houses in predominantly Black neighborhoods have been generally appraised also at a lower value than houses located in neighborhoods that are majority white. Even when comparing similar house stock that have consistent characteristics in age and square footage and numbers of bedrooms, et cetera, this undervaluing continues to persist. Okay, can you take that down for me, Alyssa? Some more. Keep going. Okay, right here. The impact of over 50 years of barriers to Black home ownership continues to be felt today. These barriers have meant a disproportionate number of Black families in Minnesota and across the nation have been left out of the benefits of home price appreciation. The median amount of housing wealth for a Black family here in the state of Minnesota was $124,000, while the median amount for white family was $200,000. That's just the median. Latex households, $158,000, and other households is at $240,000. Overall, housing equity make up about two-thirds of all wealth for the typical household, the typical medium household. And in short, for medium family, the racial wealth gap is primarily a housing wealth gap. Let's take it down some, Alyssa. Some more. Keep going. Okay, I'm sorry, go up a little bit right here. So policy decisions have played a central role in creating and maintaining the racial wealth gap. Race-conscious and discriminatory policies created the foundation for the racial wealth gap, and that really means it will be difficult to close the gap with merely a focus on individual choices and the behaviors of African Americans. And so I believe I'm going to turn this over to Ruth to
Talk about disparities in state procurement really quickly. And the information that we pulled is from the 2017 Minnesota Joint Disparities Study. And, you know, that report found that only 1.39% of procurement dollars went to minority-owned businesses. And so there are huge opportunities here in terms of thinking through how the state procurement process can be a more equitable process, which is something that also is a contributing factor to when we talk about a level playing field of the income and wage gaps as well. Alyssa, if you could continue to scroll down. We spent a little bit of time thinking through the education disparities and looking at the disparities in terms of high school graduation rates. Nationally, Minnesota ranks 50th when it comes to racial disparities in high school graduation rates. And so really not only using this as an opportunity to highlight the opportunity gap, but if you continue to scroll down, there is also a very significant school discipline disparity gap that we are experiencing within the state as well. We've shared that data, but also just understanding when we talk about, for example, that Indigenous students are 10 times more likely to be suspended in this state than white students, it puts another sort of perspective on that when we understand that Indigenous students only make up 1.7% of Minnesota's student population, but they are yet 10 times more likely to be suspended or expelled when compared to their white peers. Black students are 8 times more likely to be suspended or expelled than their white peers, and students with disabilities are twice as likely. And when you begin to take a look at this with an intersectional lens in terms of thinking through the experience of Black and Indigenous students with disabilities, there are also some pretty stark disparities as well as it relates to placement in special education classes. You see that Black students are 6 times more likely to be placed in restrictive special education classes. Indigenous students are 4 times more likely. And when it comes to concerns around restraints and seclusions, Indigenous students, who make up about 3% of the special education population, are significantly overrepresented in the state's restraint and seclusion data. And Black students constitute 33% of the physical restraints within our schools, while they only represent 12% of students with disabilities generally. We spent a little bit of time highlighting issues that had been raised in terms of thinking through the representation of Black, Indigenous, and teachers of color as well. We know that our state is struggling to have a teaching workforce that is reflective of the state population of students, and spent a little bit of time just talking about the history that has contributed to the challenges that we see today in terms of being able to attract and retain teachers. A shadow side of the Brown versus Board of Education ruling that people may not necessarily have the knowledge of is after Brown versus Board of Education required schools to desegregate, there were over 38,000 Black teachers who were pushed out of the classroom as a result of that decision. And Black principals and administrators fared even worse. 90% of them lost their jobs in the aftermath of Brown versus Board of Education. And the data that was available at the time from the National Education Association showed that at that time, 85% of Black teachers had achieved college degrees. So we're talking about a highly educated workforce compared with 75% of white teachers, but still were pushed out. And that push out is something that has continued to happen even in more recent times as well. In the 80s, there were an additional over 21,000 Black teachers who were displaced because of new requirements for teaching education programs and certification. And so the impacts of that push out are things that we continue to see today. And I know that many read the recent news story of the teacher of the year who lost her job as well. And so there's a historical legacy that we continue to see down into the present, down to the present day. Alyssa, if you could continue to scroll, please. This information is basically looking at college graduation rates and some of the post-secondary outcomes. You can continue to scroll. And then moving on to the Health and Human Service inequities, Dr. Rachel Hardiman was at our very first hearing and talked quite a bit about the maternal child mortality and morbidity data. And again, when we're thinking about the morbidity data, what that really is talking about are the individuals who almost die during pregnancy. They refer to that as the near misses. And, you know, Dr. Hardiman talked about the fact that Black women are 3 to 4 times more likely to die during childbirth or shortly thereafter. And when you are looking at all of the various backgrounds of the of Black women who have died during pregnancy or shortly after childbirth, even when you're controlling for income, education, general overall health and well-being, insurance status, housing status, marriage status, Black women are still 3 to 4 times more likely to die during pregnancy and childbirth. And what is really concerning about those numbers, not just because they're stark, but the reality that the vast majority of these deaths are preventable. In fact, the Centers for Disease Control talks about approximately 60% of these deaths are preventable. And it raises real questions around if these are deaths that can be prevented, why are they not being prevented? There has been a lot of more notoriety around these issues as we have had individuals of higher status almost die during pregnancy or during childbirth. Serena Williams, Beyonce Knowles, two women who almost died during after childbirth. And with Serena Williams, she shared her personal story about how when she complained of having trouble breathing, she was ignored by her doctors. And so she actually had to get up out of her bed after giving birth and walk down the hallway and beg someone to help her. And even upon begging, people were disregarding what she had said. And as a result of that, she was lucky enough to finally have someone listen to her. And they found that she had multiple blood clots within her lungs. And she was close to losing her life. But for the fact that she was Serena Williams begging for her life, that could have easily been a life lost. And this is an issue that is very personal to me as well. Having had a cousin who died shortly after giving birth, she begged for help to her providers. Her husband begged for help to her providers. She was not heard. And in that scenario, she lost her life. And so understanding that there is a concerning pattern that is occurring where Black women are not being heard when they're complaining of symptoms shortly after giving birth, knowing that 60% of these deaths are preventable, tells us there's more that we need to do. We spent a little bit of time looking at some of the history of how Black women have been treated and thinking about OBGYN care, looking at the legacy of Dr. J. Marion Sims, who is known as the godfather of obstetrics and gynecology. The medical advances that he advanced were created through pretty horrific experiments that were done on enslaved Black women without the use of anesthesia. One of the women that he operated on endured at least 30 surgeries without any anesthesia. And after these surgeries were perfected on these enslaved women, he then moved to New York and started treating white women with the exact same procedures, but this time used anesthesia. And with some of the work that Dr. Sims has with his historical record, there was a very real misguided belief that Black people didn't experience pain in the same way that whites experience pain. And fast forward to today, we still see that future providers and current providers continue to hold that myth that Black individuals don't experience pain within the same way. There was a study done as recently as 2016, and looking at half of medical trainees, so those are first and second year medical students, they believed myths such as Black people have thicker skin or less sensitive nerve endings. And so when you're looking at the distribution of pain medication within childhood all the way up to adulthood, Black patients are less likely to receive as much pain medication as white individuals, whether it be for cancer, broken bones, and even looking at Black children who have appendicitis, they receive less pain medication. And so understanding that the challenges that have been experienced by Black women from an OBGYN piece, there's a historical legacy that continues down to this day that is continuing to contribute to the lack of prevention of deaths that are preventable. And there are definitely more examples of government sanctioned experiments, things like the Tuskegee experiment and Henrietta Lacks. And if you have not heard the name of Henrietta Lacks, I highly encourage you to learn more about her story as well, because the experiments that were used upon her to collect her her cells are things that continue to have an impact down to even the present day. Continue to scroll, please. Chair Moran, tobacco disparities. You are on mute.
Thank you, Representative Richardson. Before I move on to tobacco disparities, I just wanted to kind of like highlight really quickly the statements that Representative Richardson was talking about, the number of kids who are being suspended and expelled from school, that there has been research that has demonstrated that racism and implicit bias begins before children enter preschool. The findings was that teachers more closely watch Black students for bad behavior. And, you know, and my personal testimony to that is that, you know, I'm a mother of seven, but there's also, you know, my children who will come home and say, you know, someone in the classroom was acting out, it was a Black student, and a white student did or said the same thing, but that Black student was sent to the principal office. You know, so it's that same type of behavior, but we have found that those biases are showing up, and they continue to show up even in 2021, even in 2020. So I want to pause there for a moment just to ask if anyone have any questions or want to make a statement at this time before I move on. Okay, so looking at tobacco disparities, and we raised this up because, you know, we know that the impact that tobacco have on our well-being and our health and our outcomes, you know. And so despite all the work to reduce smoking rates in Minnesota, it is addictive. Smoking remains the leading cause of preventable death and disease in the state. And we know that, right? Smoking kills over 6,000 Minnesotans annually, and the social costs are estimated to exceed $7 billion. The burden of social costs associated with smoking are disproportionately impacting Black Minnesotans, of course, and the Federal Drug Administration refusal to ban menthol as a result in adverse impact. You know, tobacco is a huge industry, which has a 50-year history of targeting and marketing of the menthol cigarettes and products in the Black community. This targeting has taken the form of direct advertising in Black publications in our neighborhoods, sponsoring entertainment events, and even engaging in distribution campaigns by driving in predominantly Black neighborhoods and handing out free samples of menthol cigarettes. A community when I was raised in on the south side of Chicago, which was a predominantly Black community, we were inundated with signage on tobacco. Those free cigarettes or discounts was a part of the intentional targeting that came from the tobacco industry. And so that impact of that targeting marketing are felt in the present day today. 88% of Black Minnesotan adults who smoke use menthol, compared to 22% of white smokers. The exclusion of menthol tobacco in the federal 2009 ban on flavored cigarettes has institutionalized these disparities and has cost precious lives. One research study found that if menthol had been banned when all other cigarette flavors were disallowed, by 2050, there would have been an estimated 10% reduction in overall smoking prevalence, and up to 633,000 plus lives would have been saved, including more than 200,000 lives. We have struggled with this concept right here in the state of Minnesota. We have worked on banning e-cigarettes, you know, lifting the cost of what it costs to for a pack of cigarettes. We've done many, we already, you know, it's a big focus on flavor, banning flavor cigarettes, but we have yet to come to a consensus about the need to ban the menthol cigarettes. And some would even say that is because we know who the target population is when it comes to menthol cigarettes. We can do better. Environmental disparities. So environmental disparities kind of like equal to environmental justice, right? Which is what we want to keep and maintain a clean and healthful environment. BIPOC Minnesotans experience higher cancer and asthma rates than their white peers. Black and Indigenous students are most likely to be diagnosed with asthma. Minnesota probably have one of the highest rate of asthma. I remember my niece lived in Minneapolis. This was like maybe over 20 plus years ago. She gave birth to a little girl. Her baby, you know, had asthma. In the first 3 years of her life, she was in and out of the hospital to her mother. My sister finally said to her, you need to come home because you need some help. Your family needs some help. You need to be with family. They left Minnesota. And I promise you, also what happened with my little niece moving was that her asthma didn't feel the impact of the asthma anymore. She is a healthy young woman herself now who had never, and I mean never, had one asthma attack once she returned home. It was the environment in Minneapolis, some would say. So there are also disparities in the death rate due to asthma, as Black Minnesotan death rates are 4 times higher than other white peers. And overall, Indigenous Minnesotans have the highest rate of cancer diagnosis and mortality in the state. These health disparities have linked to higher concentration of environmental pollution in these communities. Empirical evidence of environmental injustice along racial and economic lines have been produced time and again. Vulnerable populations continue to bear a disproportionate burden of society's environmental harms. as illustrated in the recent water crisis like in Flint, Michigan, and in St. Joseph, Louisiana. We also was able to see this type of behavior in Minnesota. For example, in North Minneapolis, where the metal shredders, North Meadows, violated pollution standards. A high degree of lead poisoning and asthma was detected in nearby neighborhoods and homes. So according to the air pollution model provided by the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, there are stark and significant environmental racial disparities related to air quality. 32% of all communities have air pollution-related risks above health guidelines. However, the percentage of BIPOC Minnesotans that experience air pollution-related risks above health guidelines are far higher at 91%. That is where we are. Dental disparities in Minnesota. Dental disease is the most common chronic childhood illness in Minnesota, exceeding the cases of asthma, diabetes, obesity, and leading up to thousands of hours of missed school and work. Low-income children and families in BIPOC Minnesotans are more severely affected. BIPOC children in Minnesota are less likely to receive dental sealants to prevent cavities and more likely to have untreated cavities than their white peers. Among adults, Black and Indigenous men have the highest rates of oral cavities and flagellum cancer. I'm probably messing up that word, but cancer. Poor oral health and indicators for more chronic health conditions such as heart disease, arthritis, stroke. Many of us wonder and will push that dental care should be and must be health care. I think, I'm not sure, Representative Richardson, are you doing the COVID hospitalization mortality rate, or should I continue on with that?
Sure, I can do that as well. So I think we've all had a number of conversations around the disproportionate impact that COVID has been having on BIPOC communities as well. When you look at age-adjusted rates for hospitalization of COVID, Indigenous individuals are facing some of the highest rates within our states in terms of hospitalization. And then you can continue to scroll down. And also looking, there are clear disparities also within Asian Americans who are diagnosed with COVID-19 as well. There are disparities looking at the ICU rates of the general population versus BIPOC communities, and there, and even within groups, it's important to note that, as brought out in the 2019 Eliminating Health Disparities Initiative report, that when data is further disaggregated, you can begin to see even greater disparities within some groups, looking specifically at Cambodian and Laotian populations as well. And so I'll turn it over to you for family separation.
Yes. And so for transparency purposes, yes, we did not hear within committee much around family separation, the child welfare system, out-of-home placement. But this is something that I was adamant that we could not go on without bringing in this piece into the report. It is important because for Black and Indigenous and for people of color, family is important. Family is important. Families is critical. But we have a history here around family separation. Separation of BIPOC children from their family has a long history in America and in Minnesota. Policies have been used as weapons to foster exclusion and separation, and has impacted Black families during slavery, Indigenous families during the boarding school era, and the Japanese American during the internment, just to name a few. In Minnesota, The Dakota and Ojibwe children have been forcibly separated by their families for centuries, including in 1862 when Dakota elders, women, and children were forcibly removed from concentration camps at Fort Snelling, while Dakota men were moved to a military installation in Davenport, Iowa. Not all families were able to unify following that forced separation. Could you scroll down, Alyssa? So this forced separation of children from their families continued throughout the boarding school era. Many indigenous families experienced children being ripped away from their parents and sent to military-style institutions designed to promote the cultural genocide based on the philosophy of kill the Indian, save the man. Minnesota had 16 boarding schools that drew children from all 11 tribes. Children were forced to renounce their religion beliefs, cut their hair, abandon their identities, and was forbidden from speaking their ancestry language. Some children were then leased out to white families as indentured servants. Many parents who resisted were arrested or punished, and their children were forcibly taken. The children were condemned to schools with insufficient foods, overcrowded dorms, substantial medical care, and exploitative child labor practices. This forced families have left deep scars and a legacy of intergenerational trauma, unresolved grief, and pain that continues in our state and in our nations today. This practice went on until the passing of the Indian Child Welfare Act of 1978, when Native American parents were given the legal right to refuse boarding school education. This harmful legacy of family separation and intergenerational trauma also exists for descendants of enslaved Black people during the Chattel slavery. There was daily buying and selling of children. No legal restraints existed on slave owners who chose to dispose of their property as they saw fit. The internment of people of Japanese descent was also a time of enactment of exclusionary policies by the American government. It was President Roosevelt ordered that Japanese, many of them United States citizens, be forcibly removed and held in camps. Children, even infants, were placed in these camps with their parents and sometimes without their parents. So, as has been done today with undocumented children, and BIPOC children, the separation were staunchly defended and rationalized without much consideration of the negative and long-lasting trauma. So according to scholars who have spent many years researching the multi-generational trauma, millions of people who endure slavery continue to pass on behavior such as anger, violence, and shame down to contemporary generations. Scholars have also researched the impact of American Indian boarding schools. Their findings include reports of abuse in boarding schools and how that manifested in their later years. As children, they were found to have high level of depression. Research has also linked the adverse childhood experiences, ACEs, of boarding schools with difficulty to managing stress as adults. The research is clear, and it demonstrates that multiple out-of-home placement is harmful for children and families. The inability can lead to profound distress, and children can also experience a loss of belonging. Family separation is a traumatic experience, and the deep wounds have both a physical and a psychological impact on children and can be disruptive to their environment. Separation can impact attachment and emotional development. Left unresolved, these challenges can persist and cause issues that continue into adulthood. We are all a reflection of our childhood, all of us. While it is possible to seek to mitigate the consequences of adverse childhood experiences with the appropriate support, it is important to note that there are long-lasting and intergenerational impacts related to family separations. And so within our child welfare system, and so today with children being removed from homes, from their homes, from their family, from the community, and sometimes from the school, children are being traumatized. And that traumatization can have lifelong experiences that is repeated from generation to generation to generation. Can you scroll down, Alyssa? And I want to start with the forced separation of children from their families continued throughout the boarding school era. So the harmful legacy of family separation. The harmful legacy of family separation and an intergenerational trauma also exists for descendants of enslaved people. Oh, I read that. I'm sorry, you guys. I'm a little bit behind here. So I'm going to scroll down to Minnesota has significant racial disparities in out-of-home care. Black and American Indian children are disproportionately likely to experience out-of-home care. Compared to white children, Black children in Minnesota are 2.3 times more likely to be involved in a report of maltreatment and 2.9 times more likely to experience out-of-home placement. Many elements of the child welfare system, such as workers' bias, cultural misunderstanding, distrust between staff and families, communities or neighborhood risks, and other parent and family factors contribute to racial disproportionality in the child welfare system. And I just want to say that poverty is not a basic for bringing children into foster care. And families have a right to raise their children regardless of how much money they have or how much food is in the refrigerator. In the United States, a country with a lot of resources, it is criminal to take children away from their families because they do not have food in the home. The solution is to help the family get food, and we need to figure out how to get families the resources they need. The state spends more money to have a child in foster care than what it costs to support the family basic needs. We must flip this script. If we believe in families, if we think families are important, then we need to figure out how to get resources to family rather than someone else. When we spend money on the front end, the outcomes are much better. We need to make sure that we are not doing, as some has hinted, neglect and abuse, which is often in the past how most kids were removed from their homes. Now there's a bigger case of children being removed from their home because of substance abuse. But we need to make sure that we are not doing, as some has hinted, around the neglect and abuse are often just the nice and more acceptable terms for poverty. Because substance abuse is also going on in rich households, but often those children are not removed from their homes. So there are currently 25 states in the District of Columbia and one indigenous tribe that are participating in the Federal Child Welfare Demonstration Project. This demonstration project gives states and tribes the ability to apply for a waiver so that they may better target and allocate their respective shares of the Title IV foster care dollars. Minnesota is not currently participating in this demonstration waiver. And so we're going to move on into public safety. Public safety, I have to share with you guys, was one of these institutions or areas that is expansive. And there's so much that could be done, should be done, need to be talked about. But Representative and myself, we wanted to really focus on the moment that we are in. right now in 2020. And a lot of this that we're in really is around policing, right? I've been able to had the honor and privilege to be a part of the negotiation that took place in the police accountability legislation that we moved in the body. You know, I've had the opportunity to listen to my white colleagues and my rural colleagues to talk about the relationship that they have with police officers, which is different from the relationship that we have in our community. And so we thought it was important that we give some history on why that distrust is where it is today. So in order to understand the current racial disparities in public safety, it is important to understand the evolution of our system of policing and public safety. The current state of our policing systems and the implication of mass incarceration are related to policy decisions that developed with the enactment of the 13th Amendment of the Constitution and the aftermath of the Emancipation Proclamation. The 13th Amendment, while creating the framework for the abolishment of racial slavery or involuntary servitude, it also built in an extraordinary constitutional exception for enslavement for citizens convicted of a criminal offense. This exception set the foundation for the development of an unsustainable system of mass incarceration that exists to this present day. The policy decisions to develop a new form of enslavement was to address fears, just as we saw and as we see today. The policy helped to alleviate fears because enslavement continued through convict leasing. Convict leasing was a policy decision that established a system that targeted the recently emancipated and unemployed free men and women by charging them with crimes. The system of a cash bail, fine, fees, and warrants developed shortly after emancipation during Reconstruction to exploit a new labor force where people paid municipalities to lease a convict. To create a pipeline of convicts, states created policies known as black codes. Under the black codes, many states require black people to sign yearly labor contracts. And if they refuse, they would risk being arrested, fined, and forced into unpaid labor. One of the early forms of policing was the system of slave patrols, where armed white men were organized to monitor and enforce discipline on enslaved black people. Slave patrols formally dissolved after the Civil War ended, but formerly enslaved people saw little relief from racist government policies as they promptly became subject to the black codes. So between 1865 and 1868, black codes dictated much of the lives of African Americans. The codes determined where African Americans could work, where the specific amounts that African Americans could be paid, which turned into no pay, but, you know, generational servitude. The codes also restricted travel and placed limitations on where African Americans could live. While the ratification of the 14th Amendment in 1868 quickly made the black codes illegal by giving formerly enslaved black people equal protection of law through the Constitution, other unequal policy followed immediately after. Jim Crow laws were introduced and aimed at subjugating African Americans and denying their civil rights. Jim Crow laws were enacted across southern and some northern states, replacing the black codes. For about 80 years, Jim Crow laws mandated separate public spaces for blacks and whites, such as schools and libraries and water fountains and restaurants, and enforcing them was part of the police jobs. I repeat, for almost 80 years, Jim Crow laws mandated separate spaces for blacks and whites, such as schools, libraries, water fountain, restaurants, and enforcing them was part of the police jobs. Black who broke laws or violated social norms often endured police brutality, something that has been handed down to the Black communities for generations. Meanwhile, the authorities often did not punish the perpetrators when African Americans were lynched, nor did the judicial system hold the police accountable for failing to intervene when Black people were being murdered by mobs. This form of mob violence was not isolated to the South. It also occurred here in Minnesota. On June the 15th, 1920, an estimated mob of 10,000 people brutally beat and lynched three Black men, Elias Clayton, Elmer Jackson, and Isaiah McGee. After Clayton, Jackson, and McGee were killed, people gathered around their... Can you scroll down, Melissa? People gathered around their bodies, and dozens of white men stood smiling for a photograph that made them into postcards and was sold as souvenirs. No one was ever convicted for the murders of Clayton, Jackson, and McGee. For the past five decades, the federal government has forbidden the use of racist regulations at the state and local level. Yet, people of color are still more likely to be killed by police than whites. The Washington Post tracked data on the number of American kills by police encounters, and the data is tracked by race and gender and other characteristics. In 2018, the data indicated that there were 992 people who died during a police interaction. And the data showed that 23% of those deaths were Black. And that may seem low, but it's very high when only 12% of the country is Black. There are known racial disparities in Minnesota related to public safety. In 2003, the Council on Crime and Justice studied racial disparities in routine traffic stop in over 65 jurisdictions in Minnesota. And what they found was this, that drivers of color are more likely to be pulled over than whites. Can we scroll down? I'm just going to read the titles, Alyssa. They found that, keep going down. Black drivers aren't more likely to be pulled over for equipment violation. Once pulled over, drivers of color are more likely to be searched. They found that Black drivers are more likely to be searched because of a concern of officer safety. Once searched, Black drivers were less likely to be found with contraband. Drivers of color were more likely to be arrested after a traffic stop. And so, to understand the disparities we see in policing today, we must understand that the legally sanctioned systemic racism of decades and centuries ago still matters. There's a legacy of public policy decisions that serve to reinforce inequalities in our justice system and a legacy of resistance to advance civil rights. The wave of mass incarceration associated with the 13th Amendment has a legacy that continues down to this present day. And so, we have some general findings. For centuries, systemic racism has contributed to the stark and persistent racial disparities in health, education, public safety, and wealth and financial well-being. These disparities can be traced back to government-sanctioned laws and policies that have created a system built on racial inequalities where inequities is entrenched in our systems. In our systems, we are the ones today.
government-sanctioned racial discrimination created these inequities, and only racially conscious policies can address the inequities. I'm going to repeat that. Government-sanctioned racial discrimination created these inequities, and only racially conscious policies can address these inequities. Each year that goes without addressing systemic racism costs our state and our nation billions of dollars. It is imperative on the Minnesota legislature to make amends for past and present harms by prioritizing the enactment of laws and policies designed to address racial disparities and expand access to opportunity to build a prosperous state for all Minnesotans. For all Minnesotans. I believe and want to believe in a one Minnesota. But that is up to us what that one Minnesota looks like. So as documented in this report, history and data leads the select committee to conclude the following. Systemic racism exists. Systemic racism is harmful. And systemic racism must be addressed. And so before us, we have some recommendations set forth on the following pages, which we believe are important steps into addressing our state position disparities. You know, we are known for so many good things, but we are consistently known for our great disparities. Personally, I am tired of being known for the disparities that we find Minnesota always talking about. I believe that we can be better. I believe that we can do better, but we have to be consciously aware also. And so I would stop there before we go through any of the recommendations and ask anyone, do you have, please have any questions? We are at the 2:31 mark. We are going to end at 3:00. I didn't realize that, you know, it's a lot here. It's a lot of information. And so this is where we are. Representative Richardson, members, do you have any questions before we move through these recommendations? We'll not go through all of them, but we do want to highlight some of them. And I'm going to hand it over to Representative Richardson to move us forward.
Thank you, Co-Chair Moran. So in terms of the way that the recommendations were put together, the first series looks at a number of economic development recommendations, and they've been divided into recommendations that don't require new funding. So it's really looking at legislation that we already have on the books, and it's more about enforcing those things and also thinking about some of the different policy decisions that can be made that don't necessarily require new legislation in terms of thinking through what our bidding processes look like and a redesign of the request for proposal process, which we've heard from testifiers that can oftentimes be more of a test of who's best at filling out paper. Work than it can be of who is most ingrained within the community doing a specific set of work. So thinking about ways that contracts can be unbundled so that there can be higher participation of small businesses, small minority and women-owned businesses, and also thinking about looking at contract specifications to remove things that may not be necessary to go to the to the purpose of a potential contract. So I will let you all just sort of look at the different policies that don't necessarily require new funding. And if you scroll down, Alyssa, there are policies that would require new investments. And so quite a bit here was pulled from the testimony of Dr. Corey, in terms of the BIPOC Capital Fund, those are things that have continued to be recommendations, I think, across many reports. And I see that Representative New has raised her hand.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm a little concerned. We've spent a lot of time going over what we heard in committee. And I think all of us read the report ahead of time. So we've spent a lot of time reviewing the report. I'm concerned that we're not going to go into detail about the recommendations. None of this has been heard in committee yet. So I'm concerned that we're not actually going to go through all of the proposals. I guess just a comment.
Well, I think, you know, Representative New says, I clearly heard you said that most of us have read the documents, which means you also read, seen the recommendations. Why don't we just go right into the recommendations? And if anyone have any questions or suggestions or comments around the recommendations or anything that you heard, why don't we start now? We have, it is 2:34. We got a good 20 minutes or so to do that. Representative Steve Sindel?
You're muted.
Thanks very much. I really appreciate the presentation of the committee. And though I agree with Representative New that all of us have had a chance to read this, it's important to pay close attention again to not only the history, but also the implications of that history. I have a couple of comments. One, just as the tobacco manufacturers have focused on a vulnerable population, maybe the BIPOC population on cigarettes and cigarette sales, I think also the gun manufacturing organizations are have some responsibility for opposing legislation which might encourage gun safety, and I think gun violence disproportionately affects the Black community and the BIPOC community as well. So I'd like to see some emphasis there. The other issue is that the situation, there was some conversation about reintegration of individuals who have been released from incarceration, and I'm unfamiliar with the circumstances of BIPOC people within incarceration, but I would really encourage attention to the preparations for all people, particularly BIPOC people, of reintegrating as equal citizens after serving their time in prison. And finally, I read in the Republicans' response talking about education and civic education. I agree with that wholeheartedly. And I agree not only with the presentation of civic education in classrooms, but also the experience of participating within our civic institutions. Places like Woodbury that I represent have found it, I think, difficult and unused to encouraging people of color to have a strong presence in our civic conversation. So those are three issues that I respond to. And again, I want to say thanks for this impressive report, which I think not only is really comprehensive, but was also really well written. So thanks very much to all who participated and contributed to that.
Thanks, Rep. Sandel, for your comments. You know, I think a couple of things just to highlight in terms of, you know, when we're thinking about the impact of gun deaths on Minnesota, we know that 79% of the gun deaths in Minnesota are suicides. And so, you know, there are a number of issues that we have not necessarily delved into within this report, and there are a number of issues that we didn't delve into, just thinking about overall the short time frame that we had around the five different hearings. And so I would just say that in terms of the work that's been put together, this is in no way meant to be that this is the one only document to think about how we begin to move the needle on addressing racial injustice and systemic racism. But it is really a step. It's a step forward. And so I do want to acknowledge that just with the limited time that we had to do this work, as a committee. I don't want anyone to see our committee hearings as these are the only issues that are important. I don't want anyone to see these recommendations as these are the only ones that matter. But really, it's more of a stepping stone. And appreciate your highlighting the need for more civic education. I would build on that as well. Civic education, financial literacy education is also critical, and also ethnic studies. Both Chair Moran and I had an opportunity to sit down with students from across Minnesota, from all the different House districts, and to hear from them specifically about what were some of the issues that were most important to them and most motivating to them, and that was as part of a bipartisan effort with senators and also with representatives as well. And two of the themes that were really consistent among all of those students was the need for more civic education, but also the need for more financial literacy to help prepare students that as they are growing into adulthood so that they are more prepared for undertaking just the typical things that we think of within adulthood. And ethnic studies was also pointed out as something that would be very helpful as well. And so definitely hear you on that. Rep. Lehman.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair.
I'm sorry, Rep. Lehman. Rep. Sandell, did you have one more comment?
No, thanks for that. I was just saying thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you. Sorry, Rep. Lehman.
Okay. All right. Well, Madam Chair, thank you. I just want to also say I really appreciate being on this committee. I have learned a lot. I'm looking at this opportunity that I've had as a real education for me as a white person that doesn't enter into these discussions all the time. So I appreciate that. I think the report was well written. I read it thoroughly before today. So now I really feel like I know it because I've read it and I've heard the audiobook. here's my question. Because there's like 80, more than 80 recommendations here that we have not had a chance to discuss, and we're not going to have time today to go through them all. So my question is this: the conclusions that are in the report, the three conclusions, systemic racism exists, systemic racism is harmful, systemic racism must be addressed. I think, I don't want to speak for everybody here, but I think we pretty much agree with those conclusions. And I'm prepared to support that. What I'm not prepared to do is take any action on very specific, 80-some recommendations we haven't talked about. So my question, Madam Chair, is, and maybe co-chairs, what are we going to be at? What kind of action are you looking for from the committee today? Thanks.
Co-Chair Moran, did you want me to take that or would you?
Sure. Like? Yeah, well, the action that we would like to move is that we would like to move, is there any changes or grammatical errors that anyone saw or picked up within the report to be able to make those corrections and then move the report?
And by moving in the report, we would be moving it to the speaker of the House and to the House for consideration.
Okay, just a clarifying question to that then. So by moving the report, would we be saying that we support all of the 83 recommendations? Or would we say that we have looked at the report and we agree with the conclusions?
I would guess that we would be saying that we agree with the full report.
The full, okay, so all 83 recommend, all 83.
Yeah. Yes. Okay. Representative Lehman, would you like to discuss something that you are, just pick one or two that you may have some concerns about?
Well, I'm
you
just
want to do all 80. We're not going to get through the 80. You know, it's pretty good.
Well, for instance, public safety is a big area that I'm not familiar with, you know, not on the committee. And then, you know, there's some that we didn't talk about at all, like legalizing marijuana. You know, that's a pretty controversial topic that we have not, you know, have not discussed. And the education piece, I was really, as you know, with the Republican report, we're really focused on that. It's really troublesome to see that Minnesota is number 50 out of 50 states in the education gap. So I think people would be looking for Minnesota to be really, really looking at how we're going to address that. So I would, you know, for instance, there's a piece under education that talks about for districts with the most significant disparities, build protections for teachers of color and indigenous teachers to improve retention rates. Well, I think, you know, a lot of us would support that if that means, you know, getting rid of that last in, first out rule that we have right now that works counter to this. So I think some of these really deserve fleshing out and understanding what it is we're supporting.
And Rep. Lehman, just one thing that I wanted to point out as a point of clarification under public safety. So I think you're referring to the decriminalization of marijuana and looking at the expungement of nonviolent marijuana convictions. I think there's two different discussions to be had. Decriminalization is just one piece. And then as you begin to think about like what our neighbors, I think in North Dakota just did in terms of legalizing recreational marijuana, that's a different, those are two different discussions. So I just wanted to make that point of clarification, and from the law enforcement community, in terms of the sheriff's associations, they support decriminalization. So I just wanted to point that out as a slight distinction between legalization and decriminalization, because one is related to the enforcement and one is related to the actual like legalizing Chair Moran.
No, I agree. No, you that was clear to me.
But those are just, Madam Chair, those are just examples. I could go on and on, but I don't want to, you know, we have such a limited time here. I want 15, 14 minutes. I want other people to be able to chime in. Those are just examples. I could probably give you 50 more examples when I read through the very specific solutions that are being recommended, I came away with more questions than anything else. So thank you. I don't want to take all the time.
Okay.
Rep. Erdahl, I see that your hand is up. And you're on mute still.
There, now I'm unmuted, I think.
You are.
All right, thank you. And thank you for the opportunity to serve on this committee. I think, as has been mentioned before, we've learned a lot. I think that in some ways will help me to formulate some of the legislation that I do in the future with this increased knowledge that has been provided through this committee. I do share Representative Lehman and I think others of my colleagues' concerns that some of the recommendations bring up more questions than answers for us, and that that will be difficult for us to approve. But I do appreciate some of the specific things. I mean, it's been discussed a little bit by Representative Richardson, Representative Sandel, the civics component, and also the financial literacy. I've actually been receiving quite a few email on that topic as well. Maybe there's a way we can work them together, but I do appreciate the opportunity that this gives me, I think, to go forward more with civics. By the way, Representative Richardson, what committee are you chairing?
Education policy. I feel like you knew the answer to that. It's like the lawyer question. Never ask a question that you don't know the answer to.
Well, I have to admit, I didn't know the answer to that one. And, you know, I'm on that committee as well. So I'm sure you and I are going to work together just fine and be very good friends by the time this is over.
I'm looking forward to working with you on that committee as well.
Thank you. That's all I got.
Rep. Becker-Finn.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And first, I just wanted to really thank the staff and thank you, Chair Richardson and Chair Moran. I know that you personally both put a lot of time and effort into drafting this, and there really hasn't been any work that I think I've done, at least in my time in the legislature, that really has been as heavy as this work has been to really dig into this and face some of these things. I support the report. I support the recommendations. I think obviously it's going to take more than more than what we can come up with in one report in one year for sure. And I would just really encourage folks, if you aren't familiar with some of the ideas and the recommendations in this report, that you take the time to look into them and educate yourself and get up to speed, because it isn't enough to just say that systemic racism exists and you feel bad about it. I think, you know, what I think this work, why we need this report with actual recommendations and to point to things that can be done, is that we have to do something about it, or these inequities and these problems and all these things that negatively impact our entire communities will continue. So I know some of the recommendations are bolder than maybe some folks are ready for, but I mean, this is what needs to happen for real change to happen. And I think, you know, that's going to make some folks uncomfortable, but it's what needs to happen if we're really, if we really mean what we say when we say we want to address systemic racism. And again, just really thank everybody for their time and for being open to maybe learning some things that you didn't know before. I know, even, you know, as somebody who tries to keep up with things, there were certainly different aspects that were new to me, and really also appreciated the testifiers that came in. We had just really some really good testimony that really impactful. And I feel like we had the right voices were here to share with us. So we'll be looking forward to supporting this and continuing this work once this select committee wraps up. So thank you.
Thank you, Rep. Becker-Finn. And I also want to thank you for your contributions to the report as well, in terms of really being able to help around the boarding school era as well. So thank you for your time related to that. And so I think, so we got three hands up, and if I saw them go up in the right order, I think it was Rep. Cagle, and then I think it's Rep. Damuth, and then Rep. Wong. So Representative Cagle.
Thank you, Chair Richardson. I just really want to commend everybody on the committee for this really extensive and comprehensive list of policy changes and recommendations. I think, you know, the one thing that we've learned through this process is it's not just one bucket that has caused disparities in our communities. You know, there's history behind it, and there's many different reasons for the inequality that we have here in the state. And so with that in mind, I think that these recommendations do hit a lot of the different buckets of policy changes that we can make. We know it's not just disparities in education. We know it's not just disparities in public safety. There's disparities across the board, and we need to address them across the board. So I think that this really comprehensive and detailed list of policy recommendations is amazing work. And I'm really excited to get behind them and do whatever I can to make sure that they aren't just recommendations, that they become public policy. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Cagle. Vice Chair Damuth.
Thank you, co-chairs Richardson and Moran. I was very honored to vice chair this committee. It was great information, not enough time, even though it did take quite a bit of time that we've heard. But a thank you to all of the staff for the work that's been put into this committee, the detailed report, and also to the testifiers and the experts that we heard from. It was incredibly important to hear the big overarching issues of racial injustice and those things that we're all faced with. I want to start off by saying that systemic racism is not an issue only for Minnesota, but across the United States. It's an issue that we as a legislative body need to address. I do agree with the general findings as outlined in the three areas. I do support many of the recommendations included in the report. However, there are many recommendations included in the report on topics that the committee as a whole did not have hearings on. As we've already mentioned, public safety and environmental justice for just two. There have been comments made that the public safety issues were discussed in the public safety committee and that we did not need to discuss them in the select committee on racial justice. I have a problem with that because for a few reasons. None of the GOP members on this committee sit on the public safety committee. So we weren't privy to the discussions that and the testimony that had taken place in previous committee. Secondly, making the recommendations on a topic that was discussed in a different committee sets a bad precedent. This committee, the Select Committee on Racial Justice, was tasked with having tough conversations and coming up with tough solutions regarding systemic racism. And that can't happen if we don't have hearings on these important topics. With respect to the environmental justice recommendations, I was personally able to hear that testimony in our small group meeting. And the information presented was incredibly insightful. While I appreciated hearing the testimony, the small group meetings weren't public, and it's a disservice to members of this committee and members of the public to take testimony in a private small group setting and then include those recommendations from that testimony in a final committee report. As vice chair, I was not consulted and had no part of drafting this final report. I did get to see a preview, but it was done. I'm also disappointed that most of the GOP recommendations made on school choice were not included in the final recommendations. While the committee did not have a hearing on racial justice issues in the education system, the issue was brought up frequently during our public testimony. This committee has done a great job of laying the groundwork and context for racial justice issues that are prevalent in various systems throughout our communities and our state. But I cannot, in good conscience, vote for or ask the Republican members of this committee to vote for these recommendations made on topics discussed in our five committee hearings and where there was no public input. I will not be supporting these recommendations today, but I am committed to continuing this work in the next legislative session and developing positive and sustainable solutions that will address causes of racial injustice. Minnesota is a great state, and we need to ensure that opportunities are available to all. So with that, thank you, co-chairs Richardson and Moran, and the rest of the committee.
Thank you, Vice Chair Damuth, for those statements. You know, one thing I do just want to make clear in terms of, I understand your concerns around the public safety piece and that none of your members were on public safety. I was not on public safety either, but I knew how important those conversations were. So all are invited to participate in those committees. And many of us on these calls, even though we were not on the committee, participated within those calls as well, because we were just at a really difficult point in the aftermath of George Floyd. And I get that we all have to make sort of the decisions that we have with our time of where we're going to put it. But I do also want to recognize that there are people who weren't on those committees who did participate in those and prioritize doing so. And also highlighting the full day, 8-hour session that was presented as a joint committee hearing between education policy and Ed Finance, that there were invites that went out to all members of all 134 members to participate. Again, I know that not everyone has the opportunity to participate, but the good news is all of those things were recorded, and there's public testimony on each of those things. And the environmental justice pieces, while it would have been great to have more time to be able to include those, I agree with you 100%. We were pressed for time, but those are also recommendations that are actual bills that have been heard, and there is a record related to those things. We're about 400 years late having this discussion, so there's a lot that we missed, and I will acknowledge that 100%. We're not going to be able to cover everything that is there, but definitely appreciate you and your support of the resolution, and look forward to working with you as well. And so, Rep. Long, can you take us home before Rep. Moran closes things out for us?
Yes, I'll be very brief. I know we're running short on time. I just wanted to commend our co-chairs and staff for taking on what is a near impossible task of covering the entire history of racial injustice in our state and putting it into written form in a report, and also bringing us up to date on the current state of racial inequities in our state. So I'm just incredibly impressed with the work that you all have been able to do while juggling legislative work and other jobs and everything else that you do to bring this committee together, to put this report together. And I for one, take the recommendations as a starting point. We're not adopting legislative language today. We're not talking about details. We're talking about, I think, pretty high level instructions for directions that the committees can take. And I know that the Select Committee is wrapping up its work this month, but I'm really hopeful that and optimistic that with the membership we have here and with our other members who I think we're going to take this work back to, that this can be spread out across every single one of our committees. And I think the breadth of the report and the breadth of recommendations make that possible. I, for one, know that on the Energy Committee, I'm going to be heavily focused on environmental justice and on some of the recommendations here. So I just hope that this work can continue and that this will be a starting point.
So with that, I just want to say thank you all for your participation. We are going to move to a vote on a motion to move. And I do understand that, you know, there's an abundance of recommendation, but there's huge disparities within our state that allows us to have to dig deep into different areas in different ways that we as a legislature can see some or get some ideas of how we can move forward in this state to really work on the inequities that is penetrating our state. I do believe within the recommendations, there is a space in there around civics and financial literacy embedded in that. It is there. I do understand the public safety piece, but, you know, we spent in this legislative body 9 hours on a Saturday talking about many of these recommendations that you see before us with the police accountability pieces that happen in this body. You know, often that we spend lots of time as legislators making decisions when we create a conference committee who go off to negotiate and make decisions and bring them back. You know, we might have not been in every conversation. We not have been a part of every conversation, been in those conversations or heard from all the people that they took the time themselves to engage with. But we make decisions about whether or not the concept is something that we can invest in and move forward on. The concept of racial disparities and the findings of these committees are what they are. They have been a burden not only on Minnesota, but our country for over 400 years. These are recommendations. That's all they are. That we hope that in the 2021 legislative session, that legislators will be able to go to a document and say, that sounds like a bill that I can carry. And they can pick and choose or not, you know. And so my hope as we move forward is that we can move and adopt these House Select Committee reports and move forward. It is now 3:03, and I want to be timely because Christmas is upon us. I don't know about you guys, but I'm excited about that. So with that, I would like to, I don't think I've heard any comments around any grammatical or edits that we need to make.
Co-chair Moran, there are some grammatical edits that need to be made. So
okay,
if you could entertain that.
Yep. Absolutely. So with that, I would like to entertain a motion to instruct staff to make any grammatical or other edits necessary for a final draft. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed? With that, that is moved. So staff are instructed to make any grammatical or edits necessary in the final draft. And with that, I'd like to move on to make a motion to adopt the House Select Committee on Racial Justice report to the legislature. All in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed?
Nay.
The motion passed and we've moved for adoption to the Select Committee on Racial Justice report to the legislature. I want to thank you all so much for spending your time here in this committee. I'm hoping it was a moment that we are more informed, more educated, that it perks your interest to continue down in this justice so that we can be a one Minnesota. There is a cost associated with this. We are leaving money on the table by discounting people value and worth. And so happy holidays, everyone. Please be safe and hope to see you all ready and prepared in 2021. Thank you.
Merry Christmas. Thank you.
Merry Christmas.
Bye.
Bye.
Merry Christmas. Happy holidays.